Hello and welcome to the American Sheep Industry Association's Research Update Podcast. I'm your host, Jake Thorne. We heard a great discussion last month with Dr. Richard Earhart and guest Isaac Machet on pasture lambing. If you haven't had a chance to listen in on that one, I highly recommend it. We are following that up today by turning our attention to another style of lambing, one that is particularly popular in the areas of the country with harsher winter weather. We are in full-fledged lambing by now for much of the Intermountain West, and that commonly occurs through sheds. Joining us to share his vast knowledge and research experience with shed lambing is Dr. Brett Taylor, research leader and director at the USDA U.S. Sheep Experiment Station in Dubois, Idaho. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Taylor.
Jake, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we dive into the topic, Dr. Taylor, would you mind providing just a brief background about yourself and your role at the U.S. Sheep Experiment Station?
Yes, thank you, Jake. So I arrived at the U.S. Sheep Experiment Station around 2002, so I've been here for a little bit. I was originally recruited here by a group of stakeholders to focus actually in sheep production systems of the Upper Mountain West with mineral deficiencies and alternatives to antibiotics. I now, as you said, serve as the locations research leader and director. Prior to that, I actually grew up in eastern New Mexico in the Texas Panhandle on a farm and a ranch system. Unfortunately, and contrary to my current focus, which is sheep, it was mainly cattle there. So I'll admit that I started out relatively sheep ignorant when I arrived at the station. But again, that great group of stakeholders, I was fortunate to have those individuals who allowed me to work with them, visit their operations, learn about sheep, learn about their struggles in the systems, everything from marketing to the environments that they graze, to the health and diseases that they have challenges with. And so these producers are kind of the remnants of the large operations, anywhere from, you know, 2 to 20,000 head of sheep that still are in the states of Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and Utah. And so most of these are shed lambing systems, our talk is about today. And at the sheep station, we mimic these systems. And so our research is housed around that type, combining the range and the intensive part of the shed lambing. And currently the sheep station, we're pretty small compared to these operations, only running about 2,000 ewes, but it's enough to set up that commercial appearing environment to have our research focused around meeting those needs.
Now, can you share with us briefly about the purpose of shed lambing and what the major factors are that led to this being a popular approach by sheep producers?
Yeah, I think when we go back, at least in this area, we have to take a look historically. I mean, going back 100, 150 years to the settlement days. And what's interesting about sheep is that sheep production was the means towards successful homesteading in the Upper Mountain West. You know, traditionally, these homesteaders would herd their sheep ahead of the snow. And then once that snow started to melt in spring and start to recede, they would turn around and then graze back to the homestead in the spring where lambing would actually occur on the range. Not all the systems, but a large portion of them. But over time, as open range became restricted, as highways and fences were established, many of these producers became landlocked away from their winter range grounds. So in order to maintain and live in the environments to where there were brief periods of the year that they did not have access to these winter ranges, then harvested feeds was a primary component. So they had investment in infrastructure to harvest feeds, to stockpile feeds. And then also in that, in trying to maintain lambing in some of these areas where snow is still on the ground, they had to intensify that, bringing them into controlled areas and then ultimately into sheds to do that. But again, each step, if you think about it, requires a higher level of investment. So in that, to pay for that investment, they had to be weaning more lambs. And so they had a large investment into genetics to take these wool type breeds, these range breeds, and turn them into a more prolific flock. And so today, sheep in these systems of the Upper Mountain West are a highly prolific in terms with respect to wool-type breeds. But before we continue, Jake, one important note that I do want to make is I will be making comparisons to shed lambing versus range lambing systems. The range lambing systems that I'm talking about in comparison are different from pasture lambing systems of what you would see maybe in the Midwest or the South. These range lambing systems are still in very extensive range lands. They are challenged climatically. They are challenged by terrain. So when I make these comparisons, it's important to compare to the range lambing systems to the West instead of a Midwestern type pasture setup.
Sure, absolutely. That's an important distinction. Now, can you provide a description of what today's shed lambing systems look like?
Yeah, and when we think about these systems, the key thing is that a small definition that we've worked, well, it's a couple of sentence definition that we work with in terms of shed lambing is that really shed lambing is a very brief period of intensive management that you introduce to your system. Basically, you are pairing a ewe with her lambs at the time of birth in a sheltered and convenient environment. So you can initiate proper husbandry practices for the sole purpose of increasing the probability that those lambs are going to survive all the way through weaning. You know, in other words, we are increasing our management input quite a bit during the first 2 weeks of a lamb's life with the goal that more weight of lamb will survive through marketing. And really, this is not a novel concept. I mean, I think one could actually argue that 12,000 years ago, the first domesticated sheep were probably shed lamb just for protection of those particular animals.
So what are some of the key infrastructure and equipment that make shed lambing successful?
No, very, very good question, because this is where a person really has to set back if they want to make that transition is again, I'm going to say this over and over again, it is a considerable amount of investment. So some of the ideas and the things that I put down here is one is location. So sometimes if somebody is starting a new operation or wanting to add shed lambing to their system, is that location within the property they have. And it needs to be a very smart location, especially if you tend to be very remote in where you live. That smart location is one that facilitates access, shipments of animals coming in, shipments of feed, also access to utilities. You're going to be plugging into utilities. It needs to facilitate sheep flow to and from that particular facility. It also needs to flow, be conducive to your labor flow. If you are hiring temporary laborers at the time, it needs to be convenient and accessible by them. And so you have a very complementary overall management flow of the whole system. And the other thing is with the location, if you have your choice, I think everybody has seen this on their farm or their ranch, is that there's some areas of your ranch that climatically are hit harder than others. And so since the purpose of a shed lambing system is to minimize climatic issues, is that you need to keep that in mind. Once you have your location, you need a structure. And that structure, it could be a closed structure. It could be maybe just a three-sided structure. But the whole idea of a structure, that shed, is simply to stop or minimize weather intrusion. You need to have outdoor holding areas. It could be a feedlot. It could be close-up pastures. But the key thing is the shed is a very, very minimal part of a lambing season. So if you have a 6 week lambing season, each individual ewe may only be in that shed at the maximum of 48 hours. So that means that you do have to have outdoor holding areas to complement the flow of lambs in and out of that shed. We're talking about harvested feeds. Anytime you're bringing in animals in, most likely you will not have enough pastures, especially if you're a late winter and very early spring lamber. And so harvested feeds and all of that support equipment in terms of feed holding, feed mixing, feed delivery, as well as bunks to put the feed in, as well as your support watering structure to go in on that. Another deal that's very important in terms of a shed is what we call here a vet room. It's just simply a very well-controlled room that you stock your supplies in. A lot of it's your medical supplies or whatever it may be, but it's also a room that you can bring in cold lambs. Remember, a lot of times on lambs in a range system to where we may not give them attention, you're set up to give a lamb attention, and you want to be able to match your shed with facilities that you can give the attention that you need. And then kind of the last important thing as far as broad categories I look up, you talk about equipment and infrastructure. Well, it's a hygiene plan. A plan is neither equipment or an infrastructure, but it's compiled of equipment. It's compiled of certain infrastructure that allows you to remove waste. Remember, you're intensifying animals into a small area. So the purpose is to grow healthy lambs, but you're also creating an environment that can grow healthy pathogens too. And you've got to have a handle on that and a proper hygiene plan and the equipment to support waste management, disinfectant, or whatever it may be. You need to have that available at your disposal.
Sure. And we're going to get back to that in just a few minutes. But before we do, I want to circle back to you. You mentioned the flow of the sheds and kind of from the lot to either it's mm-hmm. into a birthing pen or into a jug, et cetera. Can you just kind of walk us through what that flow of lambing use and how that typically works?
Yeah. So again, in the West, Intermountain and Upper Mountain West, a lot of the sheep will be herded in or trucked into these facilities. And so we're talking about a lot of times thousands of ewes. So these are your late pregnancy sheep. You know, producers will usually have these sheep divided up into groups of, especially if their breeding season was strung out, they will have the sheep that they most expect, obviously, to lamb the first closest to the facility. You need to be right next door to your shed lambing facility. So these late pregnancy ewes, then when they actually lamb in what we call these drop lots where they're being held, and these drop lots are being checked every 30 minutes or an hour, 24 hours around the clock. So a ewe that's lambed is you bring her in and she'll finish lambing there. And that's where you have your personnel. They check check the ewes. They continue to assist the ewes with their lambing. They assist the lambs with suckle and graft. This is to get those lambs up and going. After about 24 to 48 hours, depending on the facility's operation, then the ewes and their lambs are turned back outside. The key thing, again, always remember the shed is a very brief part of this operation. And depending on operational flow, these ewes and lambs could stick around for 21 to 35 days because they're usually waiting for the range to green up. So the range is ready to receive grazing animals. And that's really in a nutshell about the overall flow.
Now, are there breeds or types of flocks that typically are more successful when shed lambed?
You know, really, that's a really good question. I have to think about that. Really, it comes down to, I think all breeds perform very well in the shed lambing system, at least what we have here in the United States. There are some breeds that can benefit more, breeds that are known to have poor mothering ability or questionable moderate mothering ability. Those do benefit very well off of a shed lambing system. It gives them a time to bond with their young a little bit more than an open system, a pasture system, or whatever.
Sure. So I've got some specific questions about kind of the intricacies of shed lambing. But before we get into that, I thought this was an appropriate time to ask you what kind of research questions in regard to lambing systems have been asked and investigated by scientists at the U.S. Sheep Experiment Station?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And going back over the years, research of my own, research of others, but really digging back decades, that has been a very readily asked question. What can you do? What can we do as researchers to derive solutions to improve the success of these lambing systems? And so, you know, infrastructure and management solutions, to reduce disease rates. Again, I stated you're bringing a lot of animals in a very confined area. So what are some solutions, whether it's management, whether it's some level of nutrition or medical intervention that we can do to reduce disease rates or survival out of these systems? We've had questions from the American Sheep Industry Association actually to do a survey of dystocia rates. We know that shed lambing systems are extremely fast paced. A lot of lambs are pulled. Were they really pulled out of convenience or they were actually pulled out of dystocia? So those are some of the research that we did there. Also, the non-antibiotic solutions, that's banging on our door. The door is just about closed in 60 more days for free across-the-counter antibiotic use. And so we've been working for some time. What are some other strategies that producers can use to reduce their dependency on antibiotics, especially in these systems? We've done a lot of cost analysis. In fact, one study that we're working in now that's led by Dr. Tom Murphy at the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center, that's the impact of subclinical mastitis. Shed lambing systems, again, we're looking at a more prolific ewe. You increase your prolificacy, you're going to increase your issue with mastitis. And so both genetic traits as well as medical intervention traits, what can we do to reduce mastitis? We're always looking for genetic traits associated with lamb survivability and maternal behavior. And that's always an ongoing project. And are there breeding values that we can sift out to identify those sires that give birth to mothers that are just better mothers, and also give birth to lambs that just are more resilient in any type of sheep production system. So in a nutshell, these are a few of some of the research questions that we've asked and been asked and looked at.
That's great. So what are the factors that determine how big of a shed lambing setup is needed for an operation?
So capacity, that is a make it or break it deal, Jake. That's a great question. And it's one that can get you in trouble so quick, or it can be a gift from heaven if you hit it right on the nose. If you're too small, if your capacity is not what it needs to be, your season is going to be a wreck of a lot of dead lambs. If it's too big, well, you certainly have the capacity, but your profits may be eaten up by infrastructure maintenance because you're just simply way oversized for what you have, and you're having to pay the upkeep and the cost of all of that particular equipment. And, you know, infrastructure costs, Jake, they are incredibly outrageous these days.
Yeah. So what are some other strategies that can be used to optimize the efficiency of the shed?
Now, I think as I began to learn and study shed lambing systems, work with these ranchers, visit with them, you know, I'll answer that question with what they most comment on. And almost, the number one thing is really understanding your flock, defining what type of flock that you have. I mean, everybody's just like, oh, yeah, number of ewes. Well, that's a given, number of ewes. But, you know, have you kept track, and do you know what your expected drop rate is? Do you know what the number of first-time lambers are there in that flock? Because these are all factors that can cause great inefficiencies, again, messing with capacity of your system. And so really having a finger on who your flock is and how your flock performs is very important. The next thing is labor. Define your labor ability. You know, a lot of these operations are just family operations. So it's the spouses with their children. They're the ones managing it. Western ranches, they'll also have herders contracted and hired and working in these systems. And labor is the key to a successful shed lambing system, because this is a time where you're not going to look at a group of sheep. You're going to look at each individual ewe, and you're going to look at each individual lamb. And they're going to receive attention. So is your labor force to that level to where that can be accomplished? Because that is a requirement of a shed lambing system. So the question is, can you give all the attention to the neonatal lambs and the ewes that they need in order to increase that chance of survivability all the way through lambing, through weaning for those particular systems? Because in the end, you have to ask your question, is what I've invested in, is it resulting in more pounds wean compared to the former system, which may have been a range pasture system? Justify the investment. The other thing is, in terms of efficiency, is the length of lambing season that you're willing to manage. You know, generally, if you look at a short lambing season about 5 weeks, that means you left your rams in for a 35-day exposure. You got two breeding cycles. And so if you think about that, when you look at the numbers for a 5 week lambing season or breeding season, and based on a per 100 ewe basis, so let's say we have 100 head flock, is that your peak lambing is going to be about 12 ewes. So somewhere in that season, you're going to have a day to where the most ewes that lamb in a single day will be 12 ewes. And usually the day after, it's going to be 10 or 12 as well. So when you look at your labor force and you look at the capacity of your building or your shed or whatever you have, it has to be able to accommodate that. Now, if you're going to stay in that shed for longer than 2 days, you have to keep in mind that you're going to have double that capacity, because I have yesterday's ewes that lambed and I have today's ewes. And if my peak lambing is about 10 to 12, I have to have that capacity for about 24 ewes, plus a few extra pens in case I have to keep some ewes around that are sick. So the deal is that begins to set the basis of your capacity in terms of how to match your system with it, your shed, and how to match your labor force. Once you have that figured out, then that goes great towards increasing the efficiency, because if you are off at peak lambing, again, you talk about major inefficiencies that could wreck a lambing season, because again, you're returning back to a basis where you're not giving the ewes and lambs the care that they need if you undershoot that projection.
Right.
And then two other things is that's important in terms of efficiency, and I talked about this earlier, and we'll talk about it again, is hygiene. You're creating the environment for pathogen concentration. And disease is the other thing that's going to wreck your efficiencies. It's going to slow down the system. It's going to backlog your system in terms of ewes needing to get in, and you can't get ewes out because you're treating them. So again, having that hygiene plan perfect. And then the arrangement, the final deal is the arrangement in terms of efficiency of your shed lambing system. The arrangement is the flow of personnel and the flow of people. I mean, well, people and personnel, the same thing. Sorry, the flow of your people and the flow of your sheep. Because if you're creating traffic jams, remember, it's like an hourglass. Think of an hourglass. You have all this sand on top that's being squeezed down to a little bitty small orifice that's going to go back out into a big area. And it's that little bottleneck there. And if that bottleneck is people running into each other, sheep running into each other, as you're moving animals in and out at a rapid pace, it's amazing how much that can chew up in a day's time of getting done what you need to be done because you're messing around doing things that you don't need to be done.
Right. Now, you've mentioned a ton of factors there. So I almost hate to even ask this next question, but you know, what would be the general expected cost of putting up, you know, a quote unquote average lambing shed? I just think about our listeners who are hearing this and are interested in implementing this style of management. And there, I know that one of the questions is, you know, how much money do I need to have as kind of a target in the back of my mind of what this is going to cost me if I'm going to make this investment?
That's a good question. And it's a scary question to answer. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start out pie in the sky that we got all the money we want and we can build brand new, which really in sheep production, that's not where we're going to go. But that gives us a background of what the cost is. So if you look at these days costs on a brand new enclosed facility, so that's going to be, you know, your typical metal barn or pole barn that's got some level of insulation. It's somewhat climate controlled because it is enclosed. You're going to have some energy plumbed into there. Maybe a little bit of plumbing. You're looking these days, brand new, probably around $50 a square foot. Yeah. If you're going to have like a three-sided pole barn, so you're going to have one side that's open, so ventilation is going to be natural. That one side is going to be open towards the south to capture the sun. That may drop your cost down to maybe $25 a square foot. Usually, for a shed, you need to have, I usually plan on 35 to 40 square feet per ewe, because you're going to have your jugs in there, and that square footage accounts for alleyways, because you have to have areas to walk. So when you're looking at 100 head, you may be looking, based upon your peak lambing, you may be looking at a facility that's around 1,200 square feet. Well, I've already pushed you a cost of something around 50 or 60 grand right there. So we know that it's like, oh my goodness. So here's the thing about it. So that gives you brand new cost, and that is just the shed itself. I'm not going to talk about any of the infrastructure around that before and after that. We're just talking about the shed. I think that what we need to think about is that this is when repurposing multi-use buildings. This is when looking around your place, seeing what you have. What do I have that I could maybe pull the tractors out of, I can pull the vehicles out of for a certain part of the year? Because if the guts of a shed lambing system, the jugs, those could be temporarily put up, wired together. A lot of them use just kind of wood type structures, and they can also be taken down at the end of lambing. In fact, that's probably the most common shed system that I've seen on most places, is a multi-use building that they simply pull the equipment out of, and then their cost then is limited to just those jugs, those pens, the watering ability, the feeding ability, and things like that. So then you can reduce the cost down to just water buckets, even though I'm not a fan of water buckets, but you know, watering system, feeding system, and your wood slatted type structures to make your gates and to make your pens. So I know that's a really extreme answer to that question, but it drives home the point that first thing is to look around to see what you can have to repurpose in terms of a multi-use structure.
Sure. Now, versus range or pasture lambing, such as we heard about last month, in a shed system, for a period of time, those ewes are being provided 100% of their diet. Can you discuss with us considerations in regard to nutrition in this style of lambing?
Yeah. So, nutrition, not only is it key, but we know that nutrition is your greatest cost. So when we look at any type of livestock system, feed is what consumes the majority of your budget. And so we have to be frugal, but we don't have to be cheap. And I use the term cheap is you don't want to shortcut your animal's nutrition just to save a buck here or there. I think it's important as one of the first things that we focus on is success of a good, healthy, well-nutritioned ewe and her lambs after lambing is actually started way back at breeding. Probably some of the most common calls I get is low milk or some nutritional deficit issues around lambing time or after lambing, and realizing that there's no fix to that problem. Because when you have, when you have any system, any agriculture system, what you do today is to not solve the problems of today. What you do today is to keep from having those problems tomorrow, 1 week from now, 1 month. So when we go back and we look at our breeding time, we want to have a well-conditioned ewe coming into breeding. And we want to make sure that our nutrition is matching it to optimize her pregnancy rates there. But as she goes out, especially in these Western systems, it's not all too uncommon for Western ewes to go out after breeding and actually lose body weight because of the severity of the winter range. That's fine as long as you have good conditioned ewes coming into and out of breeding. As we go along there and we get towards the end of pregnancy, is remember that's where the majority of all your fetal growth occurs. And that's going to limit abdominal capacity. So you may be feeding a good appearing diet, like a nice all-forage diet. It could be alfalfa, it could be an alfalfa grass mix, well-harvested feeds, but realize that these are actually low-nutrient feeds. They're slow to digest, and there's only so much an animal can consume in a 24-hour period. When you start occupying her abdomen with room to where she cannot fill her rumen with all the feeds she needs, she is going to simply get into a deficit of feed. So as we get towards the end of pregnancy, we need to be looking at increasing nutrient density. And so that means that when I take a bite of food, there's simply more nutrients in that one bite of food compared to the previous diet I was feeding, which may be an all hay diet. One of the quickest ways to get over that deficiency is to increase nutrient density is to feed grains. If you're not a fan of feeding grains, there's certainly some great digestible byproduct fibers out there, soybean hulls, sugar beet pulp. These are great replacements for grains if you're not a fan of feeding grains at this time. But you're simply making sure that she has the proper level of nutrition for the proper balance, because when you get to these high producing ewes, as they get near pregnancy, if they start getting energy deficient, then toxemia is going to cause you a huge problem. And there's nothing more devastating to the efficiency of any shed lambing system to have a bunch of ewes showing up with toxemia and dealing with early aborts, trying to get those ewes up and going and everything. That's a large problem. But the next is that we come into the sheds. Remember, the shed is just a brief period of time, 24 to 48 hours. These are one of the times that I don't necessarily focus on the nutrition for the best of the animal. I actually focus on a diet that it's going to meet their minimal nutrient needs, but I'm thinking about something else. Remember, the shed is a place where animals are heavily congregated, where people are heavily congregated. I need something that's quick to deliver, that takes up limited space. I don't need to have these big feed bunks inside these pens. These pens are small. And so I always encourage spending a little bit more money, maybe on a pelleted feed, but one that doesn't necessarily have grains. So we feed like we have a mixture of pellets, 100% alfalfa pellets, and then pellets that are 100%, so it's a 50-50 split of sugar beet pulp. So I have highly digestible fiber that provides great energy. I got the alfalfa that maintains the function of that rumen. It's got a little protein in it. But the key thing is I know this sounds odd, is the feces that result from that diet. The feces are firm, And so when that ewe defecates into that jug, it's easy to clean. It's not loose or runny, getting all over the udder, getting all over the lamb, spreading pathogens. So when I think of that brief period in the shed, I think more of reduction of transfer of diseases as well as increasing my efficiency of labor. But after that is when you can play, you know, when you can get right back in the game. When they leave the shed, these are lactating ewes. They are ramping up production. So then we really look at these diets that are well-balanced. They have a good level of energy in them, and they're going to maximize that milk production. Again, you're an intensified operation. So if you're an intensified operation, take advantage of the nutritional demands of that and meet those demands in order to turn that ewe into the best ewe that she can be. And those lambs, give them a head start on that early growth.
Yeah. Now, if I'm hearing you right, in order to optimize nutrition and have that you be successful in lambing and even her time through the shed, really that management of that nutrition starts at breeding or even before right. breeding when you're right. trying to get those sheep right in the proper condition.
Well said, exactly.
Okay, so obviously shed lambing is labor intensive. You've outlined that very well. What are the main roles of employees, and how about some considerations to also make labor utilization as efficient as possible?
Right. So I'll give this answer from starting from a large scale operation to where individual duties are defined, but realize depending upon the size of your operation, some of these duties that I talk about could be actually performed by multiple people. But one of the, I talked about in the shed lambing system, they do lamb outside. So we have a title for those people. They're called drop pickers. They're the people that are out there every 30 minutes around the clock. They're looking for ewes that have just lambed to bring them into the shed. Very important because these individuals are not only looking for those ewes, but they're looking for problematic ewes, ewes that are going down because of toxemia, ewes that have some injury or whatever. They're also looking for early aborts. They're out there in the pens. You can have a rash of abortions and you need to try to get on top of that if you can, or at least identify what the problem is going on. So the drop picker is a very important person. Once we get into the shed, there's a duty that we call suckle and graft. And that is simply the person that receives that ewe. They assist that ewe if she needs assistance to birth of other lambs. They're down there on the ground getting that lamb up, getting that lamb suckling. Are all the lambs up? So hopefully it's lambs, plural, instead of just a single one. And their duty is to make sure that initial response to that lamb that's just dropped is that lamb is up, nursing, and getting that colostrum into them. They're also responsible in terms, they also assisted with birth, but they're also there to identify any immediate problems that can be treated right there to ensure the health of that ewe and that lamb. Another one is, and I just hate this word, Jake, it's the word orphan. It's that part of, we're in shed lambing systems. We have a lot more prolific ewes and orphans. It's just a tough deal to manage. So when I talk about the orphans, the key thing is that this is also a very important part of your suckle and graft crew, that they recognize how they could, because the way you minimize orphans is you maximize grafting. And they are identifying ewes that can take another lamb. So that person right there is making the decision of what to do with these lambs. The first decision is get them on a ewe. And if they can't, you need to have some manager that will manage those particular orphans as they're moved outside of the shed. Outside and inside, you have to have people responsible for the feeders and the waters. People, I can't express enough how important water is and how important good, clean, fresh water is. We did a small study about 2 years ago, and we've continued it, and hopefully we'll be able to publish it this year based on the numbers. But one pellet of feces floating in the water or a dirty water bucket, you can see ewes will decrease their water consumption 50% for that day. And we wouldn't certainly, and you really have to look at it this way, we wouldn't certainly drink a dirty glass of water. And we've learned that sheep really don't like to drink a dirty glass of water either. So those are important. You need to have people associated with both the water and the feeding. You need to have a cleaning detail. We highly advise that when a ewe comes into a jug and when she leaves, that jug is completely cleaned down to the floor. That floor, we do treat it with a drying agent. We use hydrate lime. We also disinfect with a mild disinfectant, because we want to minimize those pathogens. And we talked about next person is, we talked about a high flow facility. We got to move animals in and out. And so in a large facility, you may have a person that's their morning duties is simply to get animals out of the facility that need to move on. And you have to have people responsible for supply management. Shed lambing systems use an incredibly large amount of supplies and making sure that those supplies are stocked and in the place. And then, you know, Jake, you always have to have a boss. You always have to have that very vocal person walking around. And with one hand, they're pointing a finger. And with the other hand, they're holding a cup of coffee. You know, you just always got to have that person there that manages the whole show. But realize this was an explanation of individual duties for a very large operation. You can certainly see if anybody is listening to this as they're listening to this and they like, well, I only have 50 ewes. Well, that one person, you know, could have all of these responsibilities. So they can certainly be shared among multiple individuals.
Right. Now, I posed this question to you when we were game planning for this podcast. In a range or pasture lambing system, it might seem like we don't have as many issues during birth. For example, dystocia, udder problems, weak lambs, etc. But in a shed lambing scenario, we notice and respond to a lot more of those problems. Is it that these issues are occurring out in the pasture and we simply don't find them? Or are they occurring and tend to resolve themselves more often than we realize?
No, that's a good question. I'll probably be weak on this answer because really when we look at shed lambing systems compared to, of course, I'm saying range lambing and not the pasture lambing, but the range lambing systems, you know, shed lambing genetics, you know, they're focused on a greater drop rate than we would see on a pure range system. So we're talking about a little bit higher prolificacy flocks. So it's almost like comparing apples to oranges. Because with greater prolificacy, you can expect all of these problems that you talked about. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast. You know, and often a single lamb ewe in a shed lambing system, they usually do quite fine. They really don't need much attention at all. But the one that has twins, the one that have triplets, again, we're going to be increasing our effort on that, and we're going to be seeing more of these problems. And also, it's a matter of perspective. Your system is set up to pay attention to the individual animal, and you actually can do that. You can touch the individual animal because you have them in a jug. So a lot of times, it may be the fact that you're more alert or astute to identify even the slightest suspicious occurrence of a problem, and then therefore you treat that. Whereas if you were in a range system, you may actually never be in a position to where you can see that particular ewe or that lamb up close to identify that particular problem. So that's really a hollow answer, Jake, to your question. I think I skirted around it pretty good. But
no, yeah, I
that's
get
about
it.
The best I could do.
Sure. You've mentioned prolificacy in these flocks is important to help pay for this style of lambing. Ultimately, what data points or target weaning percentage should a producer hope for or look at as a target if they are trying to determine, is this shed lambing style really working for my operation?
Right. Again, talking about these wool type sheep, I mean, and this is a hard one because each operation has a different profit margin or a different cost per year. But on average, what I see is that flock needs to be dropping better than 180%. They need to be weaning better than 140% to be sustainable, to be profitable, to offset those years when lambs only going for 94 cents. Well, that was 3 years ago. Oh my goodness. I don't think anybody was profitable that year, but still, that weaning needs to be up above 140. That's my opinion. That's based upon numbers that I've gathered around.
Yeah, absolutely. Now here's a philosophical question for you. Are ewes that were born in a shed lambing system easier to shed lamb themselves versus a ewe that was born on range?
No, it is. There is some behavioral training in there. However, it's one of these things that like we deal with livestock, especially grazing livestock, sheep, cattle, goats, is that, you know, when we import animals in that are not familiar with that system, it usually takes a year for them to adapt. Certainly a lamb that's born in a shed lambing system and goes through all of that process, there is some memory retention there. They are watching, they're following their mother. So the flow of it when they return the next year as a pregnant animal is a little bit more familiar with them. But we have brought in ewes that were range ewes, you know, 3 or 4 years of age. They struggled at first, but by the time we brought them in the next year, they adapted really well.
Sure. Now, here at our research station in Texas, we predominantly pasture lamb. And when the ewes are getting ready to give birth, they'll separate themselves and kind of go and seek a spot to lamb. Now, thinking with that in mind, are there any issues in a shed lambing system where ewes are lambing in such close proximity to one another? And any suggestions on if there are issues, how to maybe mitigate those?
You know, thinking about that is as far as close proximity lambing is that in order to avoid, you know, there's two issues. Close proximity, you have diseases, and one, you have, you know, pairing with the mother.
Yep.
The pairing with the mother is if your drop picker is on top of the game and they are out there identifying and pulling those ewes as they drop the lamb, is that a shed lambing is very successful in creating a great bonding and with that particular ewe, just because of the way the nature of the particular system. I keep slipping back to disease. I always have to say that, you know, in that shed, in that pasture system that you talked about is that the ewes getting that lamb out there, it's getting away from where other ewes have lambed and getting away from that environment. You know, not only do you get a nice pairing and bonding there, but you're getting into a more disease or pathogen free environment. Whereas again, we come back into the shed lambing system, your hygiene plan better be on top to manage that.
Now, because we are able to observe the ewes more closely in a shed lambing system, what opportunities does this provide to evaluate maternal abilities or maternal traits and to collect data on for the flock?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great. I mean, if a producer can, they have the capability to slow down and take these records. I think on the ewe itself, you're looking at the effort that ewe puts in to bond with that particular lamb. I mean, we've certainly seen issues where the ewe just fails to bond with that lamb. And if that lamb is not eager and willing to travel and get its own milk and the ewe won't ever slow down for it, we can identify those ewes pretty quick. And if they are problematic ewes, then we can cull those out of the flock. Also, milk and udder health and milk potential. This is a very great, I mean, because the system allows you to get your hands on that ewe, you can identify all kinds of issues with regard that would decrease or be problematic in terms of milking ability of that particular ewe. And then also, because you are touching every individual animal, any other physical attributes or defects that you all of a sudden see it rearing its ugly heads, not only can they be repaired there, but if your records and you had your breeding records set up, you can identify through this system what sires might be responsible for some anomaly that you're just not seeing in the past, but you're certainly seeing it now. And that's great. You know, and on the lambs, depending on how intensive you want to be on your records, it's easy to collect a weight here. It's easy to give a vigor score, any other production attributes that you're interested in. And also, since you have them there, here we actually castrate, dock, and ID. We hook right into IFID within RFID within, you know, 12 hours of birth. So there's some other, these are not traits we're collecting, but it's some other things that we do while we're collecting this trait information.
Right. Now, obviously, at the Sheep Experiment Station, you're probably collecting a litany of records. And some of that's going to be analyzed later on to, you know, for research projects or for whatever. But if you had some advice to a producer who's listening to this, if they were going to record just one or two things at Lammy that might be culling factors or might be something that they use in selection later on, what maybe would those one or two record points be?
Yeah, for the ewe itself, you know, we would definitely want to document the drop rate of that particular ewe. I mean, that's just important. How many does she have and how many live birth did she give to? It's also a good time to do those health considerations. It's going to look at the longevity of that ewe. They're right there. You can check out their teeth. Again, I already talked about checking out their udder. I mean, these are two or three things that you can collect on that ewe real quick that will help you in your decision making come time at 150 days later when you're weaning and before you go into breeding, determined to keep or cull that particular ewe. For the lambs, again, depending on how intense is it you want to be, is that, you know, body size, body weight at birth is very important with regard. It has been correlated and associated with survivability, as well as the vigor of those particular lambs. I mean, these are all I think, easily scored traits that you can keep. And it's important, if you do this, is to standardize how you score that. Take time. If you're doing a vigor score, write exactly down how you're doing that vigor score, because you're not going to do it again for another 365 days later. So did you remember what does a score of 2 actually mean in terms of vigor? But these are things that don't really require much instrumentation unless you're taking a body weight. Obviously, you have to have a scale. But these other things are really just hands-on and coming up with a scoring system to evaluate the longevity of that, the potential longevity of that ewe and the survivability of that lamb.
Sure. Now, we promised our listeners earlier that we'd circle back to disease management and health. So I want to move into that briefly. What are some potential health risks in shed lambing, and what are the best approaches for keeping both ewes and lambs healthy?
Yeah. Remember this with my over and over again saying about concentration of pathogens, you know, your Clostridia is going to be your big issue. And one of the best ways to mitigate risk of clostridial infections actually happens 4 weeks before lambing. And that is when that we have a good clostridial vaccination program to where we're boosting. And that, you know, remember, a boost is not the first vaccination. A boost is an annual vaccination because you have already followed through with the primary and a secondary given sometime earlier. And so by doing this, we're super concentrating the colostrum with antibodies against those pathogens that the lambs are most likely to acquire. And believe me, lambing is when they will come face to face with these particular pathogens. So really my deal as far as disease management and hygiene management, a good vaccination program in your ewes is critical. I already talked about jug management. You have to have those jugs cleaned, in my opinion. Treat with a mild disinfectant. It doesn't have to be a high dollar disinfectant. It's just something that's a contact killer that will suppress those pathogens. And moisture is a problem in shed lambing facilities, how to move the moisture out. It's good to let those jugs dry a little bit. Also, if you have an enclosed facility, you need to have a ventilation system to remove that moisture. Keep the water fresh. I already talked about that. Treat illnesses immediately. That's what the shed lambing system is for, to do that instead of letting it hang on. If you can get a hold of the problem right then, try to. And also managing air quality is very important in these particular systems.
Yeah, and I want to ask you directly about that. One of the coolest things about the shed set up there at Dubois is how you handle air quality and siphon, you know, poor quality air off. Can you describe that just a little bit?
Yeah, and ventilation is tricky. You know, in open sheds, like a three-sided shed, you just let nature remove most of that. But when we get into an enclosed deal, I already mentioned that you're going to have moisture buildup. You're going to have dust from your bedding material. You're going to have ammonia from the urine. And all three of these can cause severe issues with ammonia. And you know, when you look at the latest, or the NOM study, not the latest ones, but the NOM study back from 2014, I think it was, 2011, it was alarming, the rate of the pneumonia incidences in lambing systems being quite high. And so at Dubois, you know, we are lambing in a very cold time of year. So heat management, we have enclosed facilities, so we are injecting heat. So we have to maintain some of that heat. Now, it's not much heat. We just want to keep it above freezing. But the way we've worked around that is that we draw our ventilation about 14 inches off the floor. So instead of having a top ventilation building like a poultry house, we actually have it plumbed to where we're pulling air about 14 inches off the floor. That gets the source of ammonia, that gets the source of dust, and also the source of some of the moisture. And then on warm days, when it's not 20 below outside, on warm days, when it's above freezing, then we can actually turn the top ventilation system on to pull some of the humidity out. But overall, it's been very successful for us. I mean, most of our pneumonia incident rate is well below 1%. So it's worked well for us. It may appear costly, but we've had a number of producers come in and look at this system, go home and just modify their own, just home build their own system very cost effectively. And it has served very well for them in terms of moisture and dust and ammonia management.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I know it's not your favorite topic, but I do want to ask you briefly if you can elaborate a little bit on some tips or strategies for orphan lamb management.
Yeah, and like I said, the first strategy for orphaned land management is not to have orphans. I mean, graft, graft, graft. But orphans are inevitable. You're going to have them. There's a number of different ways to manage them. You know, a lot of the operations when they had kids or when they have grandkids, there's always a side project for them to raise a little money, and they can go through the full rearing them till early weaning or whatever. But if you're not in that particular situation, you do need to have an exit plan. Simply just a small advertisement in the paper. I mean, just getting people, making connection with 4-H groups, FFA. I mean, you'd be surprised how you can get a network. And a lot of people would like to come and buy, and they'll pay $15-$20 for an orphan lamb. And you can have that orphan gone in 24 hours. And so it's not burdening your particular system. But while managing the orphans, you do have to slow down and take time and have a good, clean, warmed facility with proper nutrition going into these particular animals.
Right. Now, as we wrap up, where can our listeners go to learn more about the shed lambing strategy?
Good question. You can call me anytime. I think, Jake, this question comes up, and I think it's a lesson to all of us that have the opportunity or are blessed to be in positions to where we can write stuff up. We need to. So I take that also as a challenge, Jake, for us and other facilities to put stuff together to make it more available to read. But I would say the number one way to do it is to do it exactly like I did when I arrived here with zero sheep experience, and I just went to the operations. I found people that were doing shed lambing systems and let them, you know, try to use me no matter. I'd probably messed up their operations, but I made them work me for 1 or 2 days to really feel around and to see that. We've commonly had programs here at the sheep station where we've brought people in for a week and, you know, they volunteered their labor, but the exchange was you volunteer your labor and we'll put you on a crew and you do the full work of the crew to understand that. There's opportunities like that at universities all around. But believe me, a big shed lamber will take free labor any day for an internship.
Yeah, I believe it.
To teach. But I mean, that's a little bit. But yeah, it really is getting the one-on-one experience. And there is some written literature here and there that you can read about. But experiencing it drives it home.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, any final take-home messages for our listeners that you would like to leave our audience with?
Yeah, just a few, Jake. And really, this is just a recap. And if you're thinking about shed lambing systems, think about it again. Plan, evaluate. I told you some of the steps that I learned from the producers in how to evaluate fairly. You know, you need to think about repurposing multi-use buildings. You need to be thinking about what equipment do I already have? What buildings do I already have that I can actually use for this? You just don't want to spend money that you don't have to spend in these systems. The profit margin is narrow, but when managed well, the profit margin can be very beneficial. You've got to understand your labor. You've got to understand your support. You got to know your capabilities. Where are you weak? Where are you strong? How do I fill in those weaknesses? And, you know, last but not least, know your sheep and make sure your sheep and your management of your sheep is suitable and it complements a shed lambing system. So anyway, that's kind of final words there, Jake.
Excellent. Well, that does it for time today, but thank you very, very much for sharing with us the many insights and research results and all of your background knowledge in this area. This has really been a great episode. The American sheep industry is very, very appreciative of your work, Dr. Taylor. Thank you.
Well, Jake, thank you. And I'm grateful for the American Sheep Industry Association. Appreciate everything you guys do. So thank you very much.
Sure. Listeners, please share this episode if you've enjoyed it and be sure to tune back in with us next month. But until then, eat lamb, wear wool, and remember, every flock has different style of production, but I think we can all agree there is no satisfaction in the world quite like looking out on a group of healthy ewes and lambs. Have a nice day.